Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. We must face the future as pioneers and as a species, not as individual nations or peoples, says Dr. Peter Raven of the Missouri Botanical Garden. Excerpts from a major address by Dr. Raven just ahead. Also, Larry Somke, out in the rain. And Thomas Miller of the Roper Organization says students are reporting in with a low GPA.
Compared to adults, we found that teenaged Americans' environmental green point average, or GPA, if you will, is marginally lower. They scored 31 points out of a possible 100 points on the 10-question quiz.
The Environment Show, a national production, made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. To survive the future and preserve life in all its forms, we must live and act together, all peoples, with a common commitment. This was the message of a recent address by Dr. Peter Raven. Dr. Raven is one of the world's leading botanists and currently director of the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis. Along with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy at the Smithsonian Institution, Dr. Raven has been tapped by President Clinton and Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt to lead in the design of a biological survey map of the nation's ecosystems. In the open-air Brookings Quadrangle, Dr. Raven spoke to the graduating class of 1993 at Washington University, St. Louis, often called the Gateway to the West.
Now, for the theme of what I want to offer you, I will read a sentence that you are probably familiar with, a sentence of action, a call to action, and it is this. And when at length his wits were gone beyond repair, he came to conceive the strangest plan that ever occurred to the mind of man. Now that may seem a peculiar sentence. Many of you may recognize it as the turning point in Don Quixote, the novel that Cervantes wrote over four centuries ago, when he was so deeply worried with what he saw as a loss of the morality that had characterized the Middle Ages, a loss of a concern with people, and a world that he thought had become materialistic and heartless. And what I want you to consider is whether the vision that Cervantes offered in that great book of so long ago has something for us to say today, or rather more specifically, what are the windmills that we should go off tilting with today, and what do they symbolize for us?
Washington University was established in the 1850s. Dr. Raven says we would do well to consider and compare the world of the 1850s with the world of the late 20th century.
Now, in the days when the university was established, the world had a quarter of its present population, and the United States about 24 million people about to engage in a great civil war and to emerge from that war as the most prosperous nation on earth. There seemed no reason to believe that natural resources were not unlimited. Goods were durable and relatively expensive. Most of them were recycled to some extent, the streams were clear, and the notion that people together could change the characteristics of the atmosphere or threaten millions of species of living organisms on Earth would have seemed utter fantasy, even if it had occurred to anyone in those distant times. The economic principles that had been worked out in Europe over the decades and a couple of centuries before seemed to be an adequate way of dealing with the world. And there had been no space missions to provide evidence that our planet was one and that it was all that we had.
Raven says at the time, the Western world was developing and becoming industrialized toward a future most thought would last centuries or even thousands of years. By the turn of the century, U.S. population had tripled. Then, by the start of the Second World War, world population, including that of the United States, had grown to 2.5 billion. And so it goes.
During the subsequent 40-year period from 1950 to the present, the global population has gone from that level to 5.5 billion people, 1.5 billion of whom live in extreme poverty, 700 million of whom are actually starving. Hundreds of millions of women and children around the world spend their entire lives carrying water and firewood back to their smoky, unhealthy dwellings, unable to gain an education or to contribute to the advancement of humanity in any way.
Raven says as these conditions developed, meanwhile, the United States enjoyed a standard of living 30 times higher than most of the rest of the world. In fact, says Raven, our standard of living is critically dependent on the accessibility of the natural resources found so abundantly in other parts of the world.
Our consumption of a vastly disproportionate share of the world's resources, coupled with rapid population growth in many regions, is threatening the world's capacity to maintain itself as a stable and a sustainable place. Our future welfare, in fact, depends on our ability to act quickly and decisively. It does not depend on the acceleration rate of our automobiles, the number of television sets we own, the amount of tax we pay, or the quality of our vacations. Over the past 40 years, we've lost a fifth of the world's topsoil, destroyed a significant fraction of the ozone layer that protects us from cancer-causing ultraviolet radiation, set the world on a course towards significantly warmer temperatures because of the atmospheric changes that we've launched, cut down about a third of the world's forests without replacing them, put millions of species of plants, animals, fungi, and microorganisms at risk, risen to a level of consuming as a human race 40% of everything that the world produces, with our population still rising rapidly.
Meanwhile, in the United States especially, we continue our consumption rate, apparently unwilling to pay higher taxes or higher prices or otherwise change our lifestyles.
Apparently, being the wealthiest people who've ever existed on Earth is not enough. Not enough to allow us to deal with our children's health, to deal with the condition of our cities, to deal with true racial equity, or with the problem of passing on a sustainable environment for the future. We want, and we feel that we deserve, more. And we don't want anyone to remind us of the cost.
With this as our collective mindset, then, says Dr. Raven, how can we be preparing for the future?
To what extent can we really say that we're living up to the expectations of our ancestors or providing for our children? We Americans, especially blessed among all the people on earth, have opportunities that are limited only by our imaginations, but to realize those opportunities, we have to stop acting all too often as if we are sleepwalking. Like Don Quixote, each of us must take the individual actions that we select as appropriate for ourselves if the problems of the world are to be addressed adequately.
Raven says with the prosperity and special privileges we enjoy in America come special responsibilities.
Futurists generally agree on only one point, that the world of the future will be radically different from that of the present. To deal with that world, we must think and act as pioneers. Just as surely as those who rolled from here in their covered wagons to an uncharted but promising future at the time that this university was being established, so we're moving on together, confronting many seemingly insurmountable problems, but also with unlimited opportunities. The world is one, and the sustainable resources of our common planetary home are limited. Understanding and accepting our environment as the only possible context for our lives will enable us to realize that true sustainability is rooted in biological systems which must be understood and used properly for our common benefit. That comprehensive recycling is absolutely necessary for our long-term survival, but that only using less in the first place is sufficient for that survival. That prices must be adjusted to reflect the true costs of commodities. That sustainable technology must be substituted for resource consumption everywhere. that the Earth's human population must reach stability as soon as possible and at a level of individual consumption that can be sustained indefinitely, that allowing a major proportion of the only known living things in the universe to vanish forever without caring enough to do anything about it is immoral in the most profound sense of the word, an irreversible crime against all people, now and in the future.
These are the challenges facing the world at large, but with our resources and capacity for problem solving, especially facing the United States, says Dr. Raven.
In the sense of these points, perhaps we can see Don Quixote's windmills as the problems we must confront in our daily lives, or for society at large, or perhaps we could even see them as linked with what we now understand to be sustainable sources of energy. The environmental effects of population growth in the United States are more serious than those of population growth anywhere else on Earth. And we must find better, more sustainable ways to sustain ourselves if we in the world are to enjoy reasonable prospects for the future.
Excerpts from the 1993 commencement address given by Dr. Peter Raven to the graduating class at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Raven, director of the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis, is also professor of botany at the university and is recognized as one of the world's leading botanists concerned especially with the preservation of endangered plants and ecosystems. This is Bruce Robertson. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, does not appear concerned. His neighbors might think him odd, standing here in the rain, watering his rose bushes along the road. You may remember at the end of our last visit, Larry told us he would be working on his lawn at this time. Well, with the rain, it seems the yard work is on hold. But wait, is it? It looks like there is always something to do. Let's find out. Hey, Larry, what are you doing out here in the rain?
Well, Bruce, I'm enjoying this gentle spring rain, and I'm watching my newly planted rose bushes suck down every earth-quenching drop, because it won't be too long before the dry weather sets in, the rain stop, and I'm going to have to get out my soaker hose and start watering my garden.
Now, wait a minute. A soaker hose? What's that?
Well, a soaker hose is a type of hose that most closely resembles the type of irrigation that rainwater gives us. A soaker hose emits the water very slowly and sort of oozes the water out right through its pores. Let me show you the soaker hose I have. I have it right here staked out here through my hose, and it feels a little bit different. It's not like a regular hose because this really has pores, and the water just oozes out sort of like a condensation on a cocktail glass on a hot summer day.
Yeah, you know, it looks and feels kind of strange, sort of like an old hose, really, one you might be ready to throw away, sort of cracked and soft.
Right, it has more of a
foam rubber kind of feeling to it, yeah.
And this one in particular, this soaker hose, there's quite a few on the market, but this one is called Moisture Master, and it is made out of recycled tires. So this kind of hose gives you once again another sort of environmental halo, and you just snake these soaker hoses through your garden, and the water comes out very, very slowly, because soil in a garden will only absorb water at a certain rate. It's just science, it's just physics, I guess, or geology. It will only absorb water at a certain rate. So if you deliver the water too quickly, like with an oscillating sprinkler or with a hard stream from your hose, the water will just run off and it'll be wasted. These soaker hoses put the water out very slowly, and they actually use 70% less water than a conventional watering system, and it's that way you get more water to your garden so that you can have a more beautiful garden.
At the early part of a growing season, it's obviously important that through any part of the growing season to give your plants enough water, but at the early part of a growing season, how much water is enough, or how little is too little? In other words, here we are standing in the rain, and you're getting ready to set up your soaker hose. The ground already does seem a bit wet on the surface, but is it dry down below?
Well, right now it's dry down below because we've had a little dry weather here. Usually in the early spring, wherever you live in Texas or California or New York, it all depends on the weather. But usually in early spring, you don't have to water your garden or your lawn. The nature will provide enough moisture for you. When you do put out transplants in the spring and when you plant new grass and when you plant seeds, yes, you have to water them almost every day until they germinate. But one of the secrets to having an environmental garden and a beautiful, easy garden is to kind of deprive your lawn and garden of water. You want to develop roots that go down deep. You want the roots to be hardy and strong so that they'll dig way down deep into the soil. If you water often and shallow watering, 20-minute spritz every night, the roots of your plant will get lazy. They'll grow close to the surface, which makes them more prone to drought and damage and even pest and disease problems.
What about tips for conserving the water once you've got it soaked into the ground to conserve it from evaporation?
Well, you need to put down a good natural organic mulch, and by that I mean more compost, shredded leaves, barn sweepings. If you live in the part of the country where you can get a lot of barn sweepings, shredded bark, shredded pine needles, things like that, and you need to put that down, and that will maybe 2 to 4 inches worth of that stuff. And you can't put that on your lawn, but you definitely can put it on around your flower bed, whatever looks most attractive to you. Put it on 2 to 4 inches. It will conserve the water that comes down. It will keep the soil a little cooler, and it will also then decay and become more organic matter for the soil.
I'm just about to ask about that. We've been talking in the past here recently about your composted soil, the homemade soil. What is the relationship between the top mulch that you would put down to conserve the water and what you've already done to the soil itself from your composted soil?
When we put the composted soil into the garden, we helped change the physical nature of the soil. We made it more friable, we made it looser, we put more organic matter in it. That by itself will make it more water retentive. It will hold more water. It'll be more like a sponge than a brick. And when you add natural organic mulch on top of that, the composting process continues. The microorganisms that live in the soil in your garden will continue to decompose that natural organic mulch that you've put on top of it and will continue to enrich the soil. So you've got this constant cycle of enrichment of the soil, which will make the soil more water retentive all the time.
Finally, Larry, what would you recommend for the best times of day for plants to receive water, either naturally by rain or if you were applying it through your soaker hose?
Well, there's not much you can do about rain, so you have to take it whenever you can get it. But the best time to water is when you have time to water it slowly for maybe a couple hours to really get that water soaked in. So whenever you have the time to do it. But if you ideally under ideal conditions, you would water early in the morning for an hour, maybe 2 hours at a real slow rate. And then again, maybe later in the afternoon, just so you avoid the hot part of the day where all that water can be lost to evaporation.
Well, we had planned to do a little work on the lawn, but with the rain, it doesn't seem to be too hospitable to get out here and stand in the rain too much. So maybe next time we'll see what's happening out on the lawn.
You know, all this rain is going to make that lawn grow fast, so we better get with it.
Check out your lawnmower. See you next time, Larry.
Take care.
Larry Somke, the environmental gardener and noted author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. If the weather cooperates, next time we will talk about lawns. From Hollowville, New York, this is Bruce Robertson. On a recent exam given to high school students across the nation, a disturbingly high number failed and posted low GPAs as a result. Among those failing were students with high grade point averages. You see, the exam tested the student's green point average. The exam, similar to one given a year ago to adults to test the same quotient, was administered by the Roper Organization. Thomas Miller, Senior Vice President.
We found, quite to our mind, surprisingly, that teenaged Americans did actually a little bit less well on this environmental knowledge quiz than did adults. We frankly were expecting that teens would do better in this exercise, but our expectations proved to be optimistic. Compared to adults, we found that teenaged Americans' environmental green point average, or GPA, if you will, is marginally lower. They scored 31 points out of a possible 100 points on the 10-question quiz. Adults, meanwhile, fared a little bit better back a year and a half ago. They got an average score of 33 points on the quiz.
What were the questions that you asked the students, and how did you know, how did you select those questions to give a good representation of what they did or did not know environmentally?
Well, we had basically two sets of questions. We had five true-false questions, and we had five multiple-choice questions. We attempted to select questions to cover various areas of environmental concern. So certain questions were sort of targeted at issues of water pollution, others air pollution, others solid waste, and yet a fourth group targeted at more broadly conservation types of issues. In terms of how we selected the questions, our first criterion was that the questions needed to be factual. In other words, we wanted to, because we were trying to understand the level of knowledge of individuals, we need to ask people questions to which there were proven scientific factual answers. And in just in putting together this questionnaire, we had to do an awful lot of research and drawing extensively on input and expertise from the environmental communities, the scientific communities in this country, in order to come up with questions to which there are known proven scientific answers.
Without going down the full list of the 10 questions on the quiz, on the exam, tell us, what was the typical question that most students seemed to answer correctly, and then by contrast, what was the consistent stumbling block?
Well, one question that students did quite well on, you may have heard that the populations of American ducks and geese have been declining over the past decade. Is that primarily because of parasites and diseases, or loss of wilderness habitat, or hunters, or air pollution? And the correct answer was loss of wilderness habitat, answered by 38% of students, and that was indeed a plurality, or in other words, the largest group of students, in fact, correctly picked that response category. The number one question in which they were way off the mark had to do with the question was the following. You may, in 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker spilled 10 to 11 million gallons of oil off the coast of Alaska. Compared to this amount spilled by the Valdez, how much used motor oil would you say is dumped by car owners into drains and sewers each year? Is it less than one-tenth the amount of the Valdez oil spill, about half the amount of the Valdez oil spill, twice as much, or more than 10 times as much as the Valdez oil spill? Well, the correct answer is the last one, more than 10 times as much. Used motor oil is improperly discarded by motorists every year, as was spilled by the Exxon Valdez several years ago. Only 9% of teens got that one right, and only 10% of adults, incidentally, got that one right as well.
Thomas Miller, Senior Vice President of the Roper Organization in New York. The organization conducted the poll as it was commissioned by S.C. Johnson & Son, the Wisconsin manufacturers of waxes and cleaning products. Miller says the conclusions to be drawn are not clear. While school education is surely at least partly to blame, Miller suggests we in the media have also failed to some degree in getting the message explained and expressed. One conclusion, however, is inescapable. If we do not know where we are, how are we ever to know where we are going? By the way, did you know the oil spill answer? This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the report and will join us next week at this time. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Our thanks this week to Judith Jasper and Susan Killenberg at Washington University, who helped out on this week's broadcast. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 177. That's 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 177. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.